This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. They might not call themselves that, but we sure can say that about them, men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And each week, we have the privilege of visiting with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn quite a bit. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories. And I'm pretty sure that's going to be the case today. I say educated, and we've got a longtime educator that I'm visiting with in snowy Laramie, Wyoming, where he's lived since 1959. But he saw a much different part of the world during World War II, and we're going to hear about it. Bill Gunther, 93 years old, and I asked you where you grew up. You said all over the Midwest. Now, the Great Depression made things difficult for your family. You moved a lot, huh?
Yeah, that's true.
What were some of the spots that you got to grace with your presence?
One town in southwestern North Dakota called Marmots, one in the Sand Hills of Nebraska called Crookston, and several places in Iowa. And
you ended up in Wisconsin by the time you were a high schooler, huh?
Yeah, my last year was we lived in a town called Lavelle, which was 7 miles from where the area high school was located, in a bigger community called Reedsburg, which served as the high school for several little communities around that area.
You're not going to tell me that you had to walk uphill both ways through the snow 7 miles to high school, are you?
No. There were two cars from Lavelle that went to Reedsburg, and each one had five or six students in it. So two of the students drove cars, and then the rest of us paid money for riding, something like $1 a week maybe, or some fantastic something like that.
Now, did you have siblings?
Yes. I was the oldest. I have a sister that, as far as I know, is still alive.
So growing up, you mentioned moving because of the Depression as your father tried to find work in different places. But what about you? Did you have some ambitions? Did you have some dreams that you were hoping to pursue?
Oh, not really. I just enjoyed some of the little towns we lived in because kids could be turned loose and run free. And
you never got in any trouble or anything, though, did you?
Oh, I suppose my share. Nothing real bad, though.
Well, and I can look now at photos of you as a member of the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II, and I know you're a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross, but I'm curious, when you first got the idea that getting up there in the air, that aviation might be something exciting for you?
Well, when the war started, it seemed apparent that I would soon be drafted, and if so, I wouldn't get any choice of the service, and then the Air Force came up with this reserve program, and college students all over the country went for that, and I was one of them.
And you're at the University of Iowa, and I'm guessing that's where you were on December 7th, 1941.
That's right.
What do you remember about that day? How'd you find out that the Japanese had attacked?
Oh, I was busy studying. It was a Sunday afternoon, and one of the fellows that lived in an adjacent room heard it on the radio and came bursting in and told us. It was sort of startling news.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
Oh, yeah.
And so you said after that happened, then you realized you were going to be involved at some point, some way, somehow, huh?
Well, they started the draft. I was pretty near the top, and I knew that I'd be called sometime soon, and so I took advantage of this Air Force reserve program.
And the idea was you can stay in college and we'll leave you alone, and then things change, huh?
Yeah, maybe even graduate.
And you were able to graduate before you got in, huh?
I was, although I was in the middle of my last semester, I had enough credits to graduate. Then they sent us, a whole trainload of us from Iowa went down to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. That was not too pleasant a place. First thing we heard when we got off the train there at Jefferson Barracks, the guys that had been there a week and already had their uniforms, every place we went, they told us, you aren't going to like it here. And it was true. We didn't like it.
What was so miserable about it?
Oh, the weather, and I suppose just getting used to the service. And the latrine that we used was probably a quarter of a mile away from our barracks. It was one of those big latrines with about 60 stools in it. One time they fed us something that gave everybody the GIs. Do you know what the GIs are?
I've heard about the GIs, yeah.
Well, anyway, I had to go down to the latrine, and I couldn't find a stool. They were all taken. Mm-hmm. That was in the middle of the night, so I wasn't the only one affected by whatever it was we...
I guess not. Yeah. Sounds like a lovely place, Jefferson Barracks. Let me ask you, because, you know, it's really amazing, of all the veterans that I've talked to who served in the Army Air Corps, and we're talking, you know, probably a couple hundred easily, whether they ended up as pilots or gunners or navigators or bombardiers, almost every single one, to a man, says the reason he wanted to be in the Air Corps is because he wanted to be a pilot. Mm-hmm. Did you have those ambitions?
Oh, not really. They gave us a chance to fly little planes, but they soon decided, and I'm glad they did, because I think it was the best position in the plane, that I'd be a navigator.
Why was that the best position in the plane?
What convinced you could see what was going on. The poor pilots were so busy keeping the planes in formation, I don't think they saw much, but the other planes and the flak.
So you had a good view, you weren't stuck out there in the nose like a bombardier.
No, that we had a window off the side, both sides, in fact.
So what were there some challenges to being trained as a navigator? Some of the curriculum and the skills that you had to acquire, were any of those difficult for you to master?
Oh, no.
You'd always been a math whiz, I guess, huh?
Well, I already had a degree in mathematics, and so everything was fairly easy for me to learn that I didn't know before.
So when they talk to you about being a navigator, you know this is going to be on bombers, right?
No.
You didn't know?
Didn't know what kind of plane. Oh, it probably would be on a bomber, but not necessarily B-17s. Could have been B-24s or maybe even B-26s. I don't know. And eventually B-29s. So you had no idea where you'd be assigned.
You had no idea you'd be completing 35 missions in B-17s.
No.
What was your first impression of that flying fortress the first time you got on one?
Oh, I thought it was a good plane. It was fairly stable and apparently easy to fly. Our competitor, really, in Europe was the B-24. But I never saw a B-24 in England. I suppose there were some. Some people called the B-24 the flying coffin.
Yeah.
Have you heard that before?
I've heard that. The flying anvil, too. That was. I didn't like the design.
My cousin turned out to be a B-24 pilot in Italy, and they got shot down. But I think everybody got out of the plane, and they all survived as prisoners of war.
So he was a POW the rest of the war.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that gives you a little perspective on what you were doing, doesn't it? As you're going through your training, were you getting antsy to get overseas and be a part of this?
No.
You were content to stay right here in the States?
Well, I didn't think about it.
When was it that they sent you that way?
We went overseas in September of 1944. We flew a plane by the northern route, which we picked it up in Lincoln, Nebraska, flew to Manchester, New Hampshire, and stayed there one night, and then we flew to Goose Bay, Labrador, and usually you'd stay there one night, although the weather was not conducive to continuing, so we stayed an extra night in Goose Bay. And then we flew to Iceland and then to Wales, where we deposited our plane and were assigned to a group in this place in Wales. We were taken by train across England to our base, which was halfway between Norwich and Ipswich.
Was that a pretty exciting adventure for you at the time?
Oh, Well, it was new and exciting, I guess. Yeah, when you're young, everything's exciting. I had a chance to navigate across the North Atlantic. Not that that's a big deal, but a lot of guys went over on boats, so he got to see a little more country.
And you didn't even have to adjust to any bad weather on the way?
No, it was good enough.
I've heard some nightmare stories about that northern route and guys having some trouble, especially in Iceland.
The key to the navigating is to getting good weather information, and we got frequent weather reports on wind directions and velocities.
Mm-hmm.
That's mainly what you needed.
How about your crew? Did you have the luxury of going overseas with a group of guys you had trained with for quite a while?
No, just we didn't know each other until we got to the combat crew training in Alexandria, Louisiana. So I didn't know anybody when I got there, and the same with all the other guys. They all came from different schools and training.
Did you form a pretty quick bond, or was it?
Oh, yeah. We didn't have any trouble. We flew training flights around England, and it was probably 3 weeks or so, perhaps, before we went on our first mission. I do have a list of the missions that they gave me. Don't know how accurate it is, but I do have such a list of all the places we went.
So help us understand what your job was as the navigator of that crew. And this is a 10-man crew, correct, on a B-17?
Nine.
Nine-man crew.
We flew with nine men.
So as the navigator for your B-17, what did your duties consist of, and what kind of responsibility did you have?
Well, I had to know where we were at all times. Of course, we were following in formation, but at any time you might have to drop out of formation, and you'd have to know where you were and how to get where you want to go. And
mm-hmm.
One time, we did drop out of formation and headed back towards home by ourselves, and the pilot thought the plane was in bad enough condition that he wanted to land in northern France and get replies, and we did land at a base that had already belonged to the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little town called Fourdrain, which is near San Quentin in northern France. In World War I, there was a lot of fighting in that area, and there was this little town where we stayed, there was a grave for German soldiers that had been buried there from World War I.
Hmm. Let me rewind you a little bit on that story, because you told us the pilot felt like the plane needed to drop from formation. I have a feeling there's something that precipitated that. You guys made your bomb run.
Yeah.
At some point. You had some enemy ACAT coming your way, or was it fighters, or what?
No, it was damage from ACAT, as you call it.
Is there German 88s probably on the ground shooting at you?
Yeah. Well, we usually had pretty accurate information of the number of guns that would be shooting at us. Of course, what you hope for, there weren't very many. If you didn't get shot at, and then that was called a milk run. You've heard that title before.
Yeah, milk run, sure. How frequently did you guys get shot at?
Oh, most every time.
Almost every mission.
But the intensity of the fire varied. Probably the most highly defended target in the last year of the war was at Merseburg, because that's where one of their oil refineries were, and they'd lost their other supplies of oil by that time that they got from Romania or other places. And
mm-hmm.
They must have had 600 guns shooting at you when you went by there.
That's a lot. Well, and some people might not understand that you're kind of helpless in that situation, aren't you? If you're in formation?
Yeah, you're in formation.
And you can't break formation to dodge...
No.
Enemy artillery fire.
Not while you're dropping the bombs. You all got to be together. And so the lead bombardier drops the bombs, and all the other bombardiers drop theirs at the same time.
So help me understand what it was like for you. You're sitting in your position, the navigator's perch that you described, and you can see the black puffs of smoke. You can see the flak in front of you. Know you're going to fly through it?
Yeah, one advantage of flying at high elevation like we did was these shells go off and they make very little noise because the air doesn't carry the sound. And the poor guys on the ground that were shooting those guns, their eardrums took a beating, I'm sure, from the loud noise of the exploding shells. Well, we never had to put up with that because there was so little air there that it would just sound like a pop.
Well, hearing it's one thing, feeling it's another.
Yeah.
And we'll hear what it felt like for Bill Gunther when we come back. If you want to see what Bill looked like then and what he looks like now, pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or just go to hometownheroesradio.com. I also have a link there to a really cool website. It's the online home of the 95th Bomb Group Memorials Foundation, and it is a fountain of information. Great photos, history. You can pull up individual members of the group like Bill and get a list of every one of his 35 missions. It's pretty extensive, and again, I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. We'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.